back, everyone. We are here after a really long hiatus. We're really sorry about that. And if you're still joining us, and if you were eager for the return of these podcasts, bless you. We appreciate your patience and sticking with us. We're here today to talk about number 31, The Conspiracy, which is not an apt name at all. Like, at all.
I think it is.
Oh, okay. Tell me your idea.
There is a yurt conspiracy to literally assassinate a man.
True. Okay, fair.
We read the same book, right?
Yes, I hope.
Okay.
We'll find out.
I mean, it is kind of a... It does make it sound like it's way more, like, broad-reaching.
Sprawling, sure. Yeah, instead of just...
It's a very intimate
one
conspiracy.
Suburban man who, like, is, you know, has Butterfingers with a jar of jam. Exactly. I do enjoy all of the mundane things that, like, painted Jake's dad as just a super dad-like figure. So, before we get into the good, meaty parts of this book, we'll just go through a quick rundown of what happens. The main conflict is that Jake's great-grandfather has died, and they need to travel to his remote cabin to go to the funeral, and it will be a 4-day trip, which is not good for the Yerk and Jake's brother Tom's head, because it will die of chondrone array deprivation after, like, what, 3 days?
Yep, 3 days.
Yes. So Tom goes into, like, panic mode, or rather, Tom's Yerk goes into panic mode and does everything in his power to try and stay home from this trip, which includes basically trying to lure Jake's dad into the sharing to be able to infest him with a Yerk, and then when that doesn't work, because Jake and the other animorphs thwart the attempt, resorting to, like, out-and-out assassination attempts. Like a drive-by shooting while he's mowing the lawn, which seems like such a bad idea.
You're in suburbia. Like, this is going to make the news. Honestly, at this point, like, I started wondering and trying to decide if we had, like, if it had been established, like, just how significant the Yerk inside Tom is. Like, mm-hmm. He's a teenager. He can't be that important. Like, they would have given the Yerk to somebody, like, you know, higher placed, or... And so... You know, the lengths to which they go to try to, you know, to save this Yerk or to make it so that Tom doesn't have to go to this funeral is just, like, outstanding. Like, wow, guys, this is some real initiative you're showing. I bet your overlords are pleased.
Well, especially also the fact that they bring up Melissa Chapman in the same book. And I don't remember things about past Animorphs books ever, especially when we go at this slow a pace reading them, but they make it very clear that both Principal Chapman and his wife are controllers, but that Melissa is not. And it really makes very little sense for two controllers to act as parents of a non-controller. Like, why wouldn't they just make Melissa a controller as well? And so it does kind of, and, like, my reasoning, especially in the absence of, like, remembering if some special thing happened where, like, Rachel did a thing or I don't know, was that, like, well, you know, she's, like, a middle schooler. So a Yerk is not going to be, like, woohoo, like, get me in Melissa Chapman's head.
Yeah, like, Tom is,
like, a teenage
girl. He's functionally useless. Like, he's an older teenager, but he's still a teenager. Like, he can presumably drive, but everybody can drive. You know, he doesn't have any weapon skills. He's not in the military.
He's like maybe
not
kind of
politically
a jerk.
Placed. Like, apparently he used to be a basketball star.
Yeah, I like even the things that Jake references as what Tom would usually do, or like the Yerk playing along with what Tom would usually do. For a couple times for me, I was like, that's kind of like a douche move.
Yeah, I mean, before in the very very early books, before Jake finds out. So in book one, before Jake finds out that his brother is a controller, like he's already established that, like, they're not close. But then, of course, we don't know if that's because they just began growing apart before Tom became a controller or because Tom became a controller.
True.
So, but based on what Jake says here, it's like, oh, so he was always kind of a tool? Like...
Yeah, it was very curious. And Jake's family dynamics, I think, were curious in this book, and they made a big deal out of that it was definitely, like, a family matter for Jake. And I thought it was interesting that... Not only did they place this book directly after the book with Marco, which had a very similar set of choices, I was really interested that they acknowledged that. Like, not only did they make that choice to put these two things back to back, but they also acknowledged that and, like, incorporated that into the conversations between Marco and Jake. And I like that it manifested at first in like a very sympathetic way. Like at first Marco, when Jake was talking to him about it, there was that moment where Jake expected Marco to finish their conversation by saying, "Don't do anything stupid." But instead Marco says, "You're not alone, man." Which was like the most like, and my heart grew 10 sizes that day. Like, they just go like, "Marco." But then later on it manifested, like they argue about it. Because Jake accuses Marco of being a hypocrite for coming after him in this situation and calling him out on not being able to make a difficult decision when Marco himself was like having a meltdown about this, not, you know, a half a book ago. So yeah, I like that they've got sympathy and conflict out of it.
I guess the secondary theme, which is Jake's leadership role. Because, you know, at one point they all decide that, like, you know, he's not fit to do this. He's not able to carry it out. And he doesn't, like, disagree, you know, when they take the vote about what should be done. And his internal monologuing throughout the book is just, like, you know, about focusing on what it means to be in a war scenario, comparing, like, his experiences to his great-grandfather's in World War II. And, you know, he and Tom have a really kind of disturbing conversation about honor.
Oh, yeah.
So, which, of course, is, like, going to be a big topic.
Yeah.
And already has been, to some extent, too.
Well, I think the connection, the Grandpa G thing, I think, is really interesting, because, really, it is the springboard for the main sort of premise of the book. And it's something that is interesting because it informs it in a weirdly emotional way, and it provides like the secondary theme that you were talking about of honor and the war, and giving an opportunity to compare and contrast our perspective about World War II, and that we consider it an honorable war, which...
Yeah, at the beginning when Jake's explaining the kind of war that they're fighting, he says that it's not a clean war. And insofar as any war can be, and then he brings up World War II, and I'm like...
Also not right. A clean war. Yeah, also not.
You're 12.
Not exactly.
It's okay. You can keep thinking that for a few years, I guess.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things that's like... we don't need to go into like a lot of depth about this, but the misunderstanding of a united front and being misunderstood for a clean war. It wasn't a clean war, but it was a complete effort, you know, top to bottom.
There was a very visible, obvious, unequivocal enemy.
Yes, and there wasn't necessarily opposition to going into war. It felt like a necessity. Everything else is then, therefore, where it starts to get, like, really messy, as every war is. I mean, comparing World War II to present-day wars is something that we do, even without, like, alien invasion. because, you know, with Vietnam forward, the type of technology... changes the way that we can fight wars and calls into question how honorable is war. And
the morality of fighting a war is a constantly shifting goalpost.
Yes. America. And it was interesting. And it was interesting to see Jake take on those themes with Tom and with his grandfather. And it was really sad also. Like, the very beginning and very end of the book were actually really sad, which didn't surprise me for the end. You know, he says that he's going to need to get a footlocker to put all of his bad memories, the things that he doesn't want to be reminded of. And then the beginning kind of surprised me how sad the first chapter is, because normally the first chapter is kind of a throwaway. Normally the first chapter is, like, you know, the equivalent of the Babysitter's Club, like, telling what Claudia is wearing and that Stacy likes junk food. Like, it's just the same thing every book.
A lot of Animorphs' first chapters are, like, the throwaway wacky mission that they should be using their powers for, and it ends up fine.
Yeah, it's like, well, then there's Rachel. She's a warrior. There's Cassie. She has poop on her shoes. Like, that's, like, what it is every... But they're best friends. Like, that's usually the purpose of the first chapter. But this one, the first chapter, I felt, was just, like, extraordinarily sad because it did tie in with the question of war, and Jake's explanations are really bleak about everything, and you know, with Marco and with Rachel, there's a little bit of humor that they inject and snarkiness, but Jake is just, like, real, like, sad and very, like, a downer about everything, and then he introduces Grandpa G, and then by the end, you find out that they do a little dramatic irony and say, you know, my brother Tom was either going to be killed or was going to kill or be killed, and it was up to me to decide. It's like, oh, okay, so we're like jumping right in then.
And also terrible foreshadowing.
Yes.
For the ultimate end of the series.
Yes. So this book, like, I think was definitely sad. And even little things like Jake talks about his grandpa and that he, like, it broke my heart when he's talking about his goals for his future and how he was like, I don't really want to be a hero. I don't care about being a hero. I just really want to be, like, a decent human being. It's like, my dad's a doctor, and I guess that's pretty cool, but most of all, my dad's just, like, a good person, and that is what I really just want. Like, that one simple goal that, of course, as an audience member, you know, is
unattainable now.
Yes, despite the fact that he is fighting for capital G good. I mean, Animorphs is nothing if not an exploration of all of the gray area and downfall in when the moral compromise of doing things for a greater good.
I think one of my favorite parts was once they are, in fact, at the funeral, since they do manage to wrangle Tom to the funeral, his dad will not be moved or assassinated. His dad is kind of funny if you think about it. Like, in the midst of all this, he's just like this rock in the stream, totally unaware that his, like, sons are fighting, literally fighting over him,
mm-hmm.
like, and that his life was literally in danger. And meanwhile, he's just like, God, why is my older kid such a dick?
Yeah.
It's a funeral, God damn it.
Yes, I do. I love all of Jake's dad's dadliness in this. Like, dropping the jam and then swearing and then, like...
the whole rope scene. Every bit of the rope scenes. And then, like, his interaction with the dude in the parking space.
Yes.
It's like his dad is having an Office Space day and everyone else is having a Saving Private Ryan day. It's like...
That's a perfect way to put it. It was so much fun.
Yeah, but when they're at the funeral, at some point, Tom says something about, you know, what it's like to be in a war. And one of their grandparents is like, you don't know how, you know, son, like,
yeah.
You don't know what that's like. And meanwhile, Jake is like, we both know what it's like.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, God, yes, they do. These two teenage boys, like, literally know what they're talking about more than any of the adults around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For terrible reasons.
Yeah. Another thing that I did really like, and there's always a scene like this in every book, but to be honest, if there was just a book that was like 100 pages of this type of scene, I would be completely like in it to win it, which is when they're trying to decide what to do, and it's all of them in the barn hashing out the different aspects, and I will never tire of seeing, even when it's a little predictable, knowing how they're all going to shake out. I mean, in this book, Rachel's not even there for the vote, and they're like, well, Rachel would vote this way. Like, we know what Rachel would do.
If I were her, when I heard about that, I would be a little annoyed.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know. Do we? Don't we? And then the next time, she would probably just, like, vote another way just to throw them.
Kind of. Well, that's what
that's
I think
what I would do, because I'm petty.
Well, that's what I think is really interesting, that Marco and Rachel often are on the same side of things, but not always, and Marco sees the clear line from A to B, always, and Rachel always wants to get the job done, with, you know, a disregard for a lot of the particulars or, like, moral qualms. Whereas Tobias and Cassie are usually the ones that see the human sides of things and the more holistic emotional sides of things. And I always love seeing how that, like, shakes out. And in this book,
well,
it was really
Tobias
great.
Tobias in that scene was
Tobias
that,
was like, well, Tobias was like a champ in that scene. Like, he,
Oh, yeah. I mean, ultimately, like, he has the correct point of view,
mm-hmm.
and, like, the plan, and, like, you know, spins off from that, but initially when he's like, I'm confused, why doesn't Tom just not go?
Oh, yeah.
And then
he's like,
oh, wait, my, you know, my caretakers never made me do anything that I said I didn't want to do, because they didn't care what I did. It's like, oh,
baby.
Well, it's okay. And then Rachel, of course, is a hero, and it's like, they didn't deserve you.
Babies.
Well, that's true.
Babies. This book is so filled with secret heartbreaking moments. I will talk about another one in a second, but yeah, Tobias in that scene was like the one who was able to be like, okay, this is, it's not doing anything is not an option, but the question is how do we make this happen? And then Marco, of course, has like the good plans for that. But the one thing that I wanted to say that was also very secretly heartbreaking, or just like a tiny little like gut punch, was when Marco and Jake are arguing about that decision and making the call about, you know, can he let his dad and brother die, or can he, to what level can he step in and put the Animorphs at risk? Because that was the main issue, is that if this Andalite bandit group cares so much about this, like, random Yurk, like,
who happens, like, this father who happens to be the father of someone who is a controller, like,
yeah,
it looks suspicious.
Yeah. But Jake says, and it's in the part where, you know, they're comparing, Marco just went through a decision about his mom, and would he be able to make the right decision in a situation where he has to choose between saving his mom and compromising the safety and the identity of the Animorphs. And Marco says to Jake, because they're talking about how they're different, and Marco says to Jake, if it's any comfort to you, I'd like myself more if I was like you. And that was like, ow.
Yeah, all these kids have way too much self-awareness.
Ow! That's way too much. It was too much for me. I can't handle that. And that happened, like, Marco and Jake in the end have that moment of, like, what have we become? Because their conversations are not about Spider-Man and girls and Batman anymore. Like, they're having tactical, strategic, like, conversations about battles and stuff like that. And they literally say to each other, what have we become? Babies. It's too much. We have, like, 24 more books of this sadness. I can't handle it. This soul-crushing sadness. And I feel like we haven't mentioned, like, another key part of this, which is, like, they kidnap Chapman and lock him up in an abandoned house for a little bit.
They do. And then Axe has to, like, threaten him.
Yes.
Which Axe does not enjoy.
No. Not at all. A little bit of guilt for Jake to burden that Axe tortures Chapman and you know, is otherwise inhumane to Chapman in an effort to create a distraction, because that's the ultimate solution. You know, they can't go on the defensive and therefore shine a light on the importance of this one random dad of a controller.
A suburban dad
who
protect suburban dad at all costs. Sounds like a Vin Diesel movie.
I kind of.
That I would watch.
Let me too.
Probably buy.
But then, if you know, they want to go on the offensive and create a distraction to pull focus, and that naturally is to kidnap Chapman.
Naturally. Yeah, it's kind of funny that the highest ranking villains in this book is Chapman, which, all right, like, I guess he has some clout, like, in the Yurk hierarchy, but he's not Mr. Three.
No.
There aren't any major players. It's really just Tom and Jake going at each other from various angles, which is satisfying. It's like a microcosm book.
True. Well, I think that's something that, as we continue into the series, we need these books that serve as microcosms, because at this point, I suspect that K.A. did not have an end number, like how many books she was given. I'm not sure. I don't know. K.A., if you're listening,
yeah,
and you'd like to
sometimes
fill
I've
us
wondered
in.
If she, like, did a Rowling and, like, knew how it was going to end.
Yeah.
Because the stuff that has been written so far about Tom is just, like, it's very hard to read it and not think that she knew how Tom was going to end, specifically. So.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I suspect she had some ideas. So yeah, so the microcosm, I think, serves its purpose well, because when we continue and we get larger and things like that, there's only so much that the Animorphs can do. I mean, we've talked about this. They're constantly on the defensive, and they don't, like, how much can they really hold out? And that's, like, the question of the series. And what creates tension is, like, how long can they keep the Yurks from completely taking over Earth as they would like to?
I feel like there was something I was thinking about this book when I was walking this morning, and I had a funny thought, and I can't remember what it was. It was something to do with, like, what the main conflict in this says about how the Yurk structure works, which is, I mean, yes, I'm wondering, like, why the Yurk and Tom is so significant.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fair question, because he's just a teenager. He doesn't have any power. The explanation that we get for why the Chapmans are controllers and Melissa isn't, like, it makes sense emotionally, but it doesn't really make sense from an HR perspective. As it were. Like, all right, yeah, sure, it's great for, you know, for them to be like, all right, you know, we'll be infested, but you can't infest our daughter. What are they going to do? They can't enforce that. Like, the Earth can do whatever they want. Okay, yeah, we'll honor this. Come be infested. Oh, you're infested now? Time to infest Melissa. Like, there's no, absolutely, I don't remember how this was explained that it made sense to me.
I don't either. I mean, is it an issue of the fact that, like, we are supposed to be keenly aware that all Yurks have different personalities, and that perhaps the Yurks that infest Chapman and the mom have, like, you know, an honor code that, you know, some kind of honor code. And it does beg the question, you know, but that is where the conflict in this book arises, that we can reason it away and say, well, Melissa is a teenage girl, like, no Yurk is going to want to, like, get all up in there. But at the same time, like, Tom is a teenage boy, and yet there is importance placed on him, which I think it just had to be created in order to make this book work.
I just wonder if there's, like, how the scheduling works. Because, like, at one point in book six, I think, when Jake is infested with the same Yurk that had been in Tom at one point, like, obviously that's not the same Yurk that's in Tom now. Like, how do they decide, like, who gets whom?
Mm.
Is there a calendar? Like, do you get to put in requests? Like, I'm sick of being in a human. Can I please get a merger? Obviously, nobody wants to be in a taxon. Like,
nope.
This has been established.
Yeah, that is interesting. Well, and I think I would also be interested to know, because we're on such a small level and we're dealing with kind of a small, yeah, microcosm of the world, or we can't, you know, obviously work on a planetary level with these middle schoolers in California. But obviously, the Yurks are going in, like, they want numbers. The whole point is to take over the whole planet and to get enough people in power that eventually you've got the whole thing covered, or infested, as it were. So you would think, like, if it's a numbers game, then yeah, it's put a Yurk in everybody. Like, it's the point. And I would be interested to know, like, what the Yurk numbers are, like, what the population of controllers, or, like, the percentage of controllers on Earth is, starting in book one, and then all the way until book 31. Because I think it would also be heartbreaking, because obviously the numbers are going up, and there's only so much that our little kids can do.
Yeah, it's the grand scheme of the Yurk invasion, I don't think, has been, like, really unveiled yet, and I would like it to be. Because on the one hand, if you want to do a total silent invasion without any resistance, then you would do exactly what it looks like in this book that they're doing, which is infest everyone. Like, the sharing functions, Tom functions as, like, a way of being like, hey, join our cool club! Like, that's pretty, you know, that's an okay strategy. Like, especially if it really took off, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a good real-world analogy for, you know, like, any religion, basically.
Mm.
Your cult, secretly. Church, it recruits actively, like
the Girl Scouts.
Kind of thing. Yes, like the Girl Scouts.
Evil Girl Scouts.
I would like to state for the record that I do not believe any Girl Scouts in this universe are infested. The Girl Scouts are too good for that.
Agree.
They would shut it down.
Oh my god! Can
but
you imagine?
Like, it was established in the David books that at least one major world leader is a controller.
Mm-hmm.
So we can assume that's like the French premier or whatever, someone who has a crazy amount of power. Maybe the President of the United States. It's not really established. Plus, because Eric is a dick, he declines to tell them up front in that book that when he said at least one, he meant at least one, possibly more. My favorite twist of all time. So in that way, it's like, all right, if you actually have world leaders in your pocket, like, then you have no reason to be silent anymore. Like, you would just invade.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wouldn't.
It
for one thing, if we assumed that the President of the United States was a controller, you would have to assume that his entire staff is.
Yeah.
Like, the entire cabinet.
Yeah.
Pretty much on down. All of Washington, D.C., it's gone.
Basically.
Like an epidemic.
Well, that's the
so,
thing is that once.
Like, the two-pronged thing that they currently have going, I think, is a little confusing.
Well, that's the thing is that once you infest, it is absolute. It's basically irreversible, and it trickles down. It spreads very quickly. So theoretically, yeah, once you got key people in place and then you could invade, it would go quickly. It would be like dominoes.
Yeah, because I mean, if, in theory, the President of the United States was a controller, that takes out of the equation the entire United States military.
Yes.
Like, there would be no resistance from the U.S. if there was an alien invasion, if the leader of the United States and its military was already infested by an alien. Like, which is functionally, I mean, no offense to other countries, but, like, we have all the really bad weapons. Which is not really a good thing in the real world, but in this universe it would be helpful.
Yes.
So, I don't know.
Yeah.
What their game plan is.
I don't either.
Or what their HR is like.
Of course.
I'm really sticking with this. I mean, they have to have some sort of, like, bureaucracy.
They're
a very bureaucratic race, honestly.
Well, I'm curious as well, like, I like that human resources takes on, like, a slightly different meaning when you are infesting humans. Like, I'm like...
That's brilliant. Because they're literally the resource.
Ooh. Exactly. Like, the HR department has, like, a little twist on it, a little twist of evil.
I would absolutely read that fanfic. If anyone wants to write it.
There have been a couple things that we brought up that I think would make amazing fan fictions, or like alternate universes within this same universe. For example, Girl Scouts fighting the Yurk Invasion. I think that would be amazing.
I mean, how do we know that they aren't?
I mean, they could probably...
It could be Girl Scouts in, like, Virginia.
I think that, like, what if, you know, you put... So, like, they find some way to poison a Yurk that is harmless to humans, and then they put it in the cookies.
Yeah, I'm just going to assume that there are other little pockets of resistance.
That would be an amazing assumption, but I can see why K.A. Applegate would resist wanting to open that door. I don't remember what happens in the future books.
Well, I mean, we can't assume that anybody else had access to a morphing cube.
True.
But there are other ways to fight.
True. So I think that about wraps it up for us, talking about not only book 31, but also the larger scope of the Yurk's plan and you know, bureaucratic strategy and structure. Next book, it's very exciting. We have number 32, which I believe is called the Separation? Yes. Number 32, The Separation. This is very exciting and notable because, well, for several reasons. First of all, it's amazing. And it's, like, a delightful, like, horror spin through an Animorphs one-off. And it's also Rachel, which is delightful. And most of all, it is the last book that is written wholly by K.A. Applegate until the series finale. I think the ultimate and penultimate books, I think, are her. But from 32... onward, after number 32, it's all ghostwriting, which, you know, is certainly not a bad thing, but we can always, like we said, we trust K.A., so when the books are back in her hands, you know, word by word, it tends to be a more exciting event. Although, whoever wrote 31, I thought did a fine job. I have no qualms.
I love 31.
Yeah, thought I did really quite well. So please join us for the Rachel Starfish horror endeavor next time. We promise it will not be 1,000 years. We will be a little more swift with it. So thank you for tuning in again, and come back soon. Yeah.